got a little irritated this morning. Things are not going the way they're supposed to, but that's okay. It's Thursday. We've got three more meetings left, counting today. So things will go quite smoothly, I'm sure. Please turn off all your cell phones, PDAs, electronic devices. We don't allow that in here, and we'll ask you to make a contribution to the Common School Fund if I hear that. And the sign-up sheets are over on the side table. The irritation comes from having to open and close some hearings today to accommodate some schedules, so we will be jumping around today. First up, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2021A. Ms. Richardson, please tell us what's going on, and Mr. Gardner, would you come forward?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2021A specifies that projects regulated under the Federal Davis-Bacon Act are exempt from certain statutes relating to the prevailing wage rate, except for statutes relating to the applicability of state and federal prevailing wage rates. Requires for public contracts subject to both state and federal prevailing wage rates that contractors and subcontractors pay at least the state prevailing wage rate if the state prevailing wage rate is higher than the federal prevailing wage rate. It makes public agencies liable for workers' unpaid wages, fringe benefits, and liquidated damages when a public agency fails to include certain information on prevailing rates of wage and specifications for public works contracts. We have before us -A4 amendments and -A5 amendments. The -A4 require the Bureau of Labor and Industries to develop and adopt a plan to increase diversity statewide among workers employed on projects that are subject to the prevailing wage rate statutes. It requires a report to the legislature or the appropriate interim legislative committees annually on the progress of that plan. The -A5s delete the exemption from prevailing wage rate statutes for those projects that are regulated by the Federal Davis-Bacon Act. It requires the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to determine whether workers transporting materials and supplies to and from project sites are subject to the Davis-Bacon Act and entitled to prevailing wage rates. It requires the commissioner to determine the site of the projects. It allows the commissioner to enforce prevailing wage rate statutes and provide waiver under certain circumstances. Exempts workers enrolled in apprenticeship and certified skill training programs from prevailing wage rate statutes and specifies a range of applicable fees.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Gardner, do you have an agreement on this one? Commissioner Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. With me is Christy Hammond with the Bureau of Labor and Industries and Jessica Harris-Adamson with the Associate General Contractors. We do have agreement on both on the -5s. However, we did just a moment ago discover a missing area on this particular bill within the last couple of minutes. Let me just explain briefly what the bill does. Basically, this is part of Senate Bill 477 from last session. What we did in Senate Bill 477 is to allow the higher of two rates, either the state prevailing wage rate or the federal Davis-Bacon Act rate, on combination projects that are both state and federal and had both funding within them. When that exemption was taken away, it drew in about four areas of unintended consequences. What this bill does is says that on those areas and on potential future areas that we may find, we should only enforce to the level of the federal Davis-Bacon Act, not to the level of the State Prevailing Wage Act in those particular areas as far as policies and rules are concerned. There also is a fee increase area in this particular one for the prevailing wage fund fee because of several different problems over the last several years, over the last couple of years, an 8.5-month task force having to add in predeterminations. We used to only do about one or two predeterminations a year. We've added staff to do predeterminations. We're doing over 100 of those for local governments a year, and it basically changes. The fee currently is a minimum of $100. It's a 0.01% of a prevailing wage project, of a minimum of $250, a maximum of $5,000. We raise the minimum from $100 to $250, the maximum to $7,500. There is a three-year sunset on it. It is a temporary increase that will go away and revert back to the original amount in 3 years. However, we did discover on the fee portion there is a mistake in the dash five amendments, and that will need to be corrected. And I apologize, we just discovered that moments ago.
Okay, tell me on what page and what line is the problem.
Basically, it is within the first and second page, lines 20, or the last part of it where it increases the fee. It was a question of the administration of the fee, and we're missing a section in that particular area.
Okay, so it's not a tiny little thing we can write in today.
No,
we've got to.
We'd have to have
six pages.
The dash four amendments, if I could just briefly talk about those for just a moment. This is an agreement between Portland Development Commission, Senator Yvelle Gordley, and myself. This requires the Bureau to do a study on diversity among workers employed on projects subject to the Act. The Bureau is to adopt a plan and conduct statewide policy process to solicit proposals for increasing diversity for women and minorities within the construction and building trades. This particular one is contingent upon PDC and other entities helping us to find the resources to do that fund, and we have agreement with them to go ahead and, you know, find those resources, and it will state within the fiscal that there's no fiscal impact because the fiscal will come from other sources. And when that that money, you know, comes from other sources, the Bureau's more than happy to do the study.
Oh, of course. Okay. Ms. Adamson, do you have a response?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors. We agree the dash fives. In Section 5, we have agreement on the language in Section 5, but the fee increase lacks both the emergent or the sunset provisions in the dash fives. It also, one of the changes we were making to the fee is right now the contractor pays the fee directly, which involves the agency reimbursing the contractor for the cost of the fee, which is essentially two checks written. We wanted to streamline that and have one check be written directly from the agency to Boley. It makes that process a lot easier for everybody and reduces costs. That was the agreement on the fee bill that passed out of the House, and that provision was unfortunately left out of the dash five.
Okay.
We think it can be added in relatively quickly.
Okay. Well, we'll put this back up on Tuesday. Then I'm sure you can get it by then. LC is just so swamped, and somehow this just got overlooked.
Our apologies to the committee.
That's okay.
We thought we had it.
Well, next Thursday, people aren't going to be able to say that because Thursday is our drop-dead day, and if it's not there, it's not there.
You have our solemn pledge, Madam Chair, to have it there ready and on time and correctly done.
Okay, great. Christine, did you have anything to add?
I wanted her to answer
okay.
questions.
Okay, any questions of the committee? Oh, it's nice when they come together and have their hands together. Okay, great. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2021. Commissioner, were you going to testify on 2140 as well?
When it comes up to the agenda.
Well, I can make... I've got two time constraints, two individuals with time constraints. What would you like me to do?
Oh, go ahead with the other time constraints.
Okay, I'll do that one very quickly. Okay, we're going to move very quickly to open a public hearing on House Bill 3339 to hear a witness out of order, which is a little bit unusual because the sponsor of the bill can't even be here until 9. So this is highly unusual. I'm making an accommodation, and I hope you understand that. And Ms. Richardson, tell us, and this is the only witness I'm going to do, and then we're going to close this and come back to it.
Did you gavel in the public hearing?
I did. I gaveled in the public hearing.
House Bill 3339 modifies the conditions under which an individual may be eligible for unemployment insurance benefits when they become unemployed due to a lockout resulting from a labor dispute.
Okay. Mr. Oxley, I'll hear from your witness who has a time problem and no one else.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Steve Erdman. I'm the Director of Labor Relations for
Safeway. I appreciate you taking the time to allow me to present testimony this morning out of order. I'm here to testify against House Bill 3339. Safeway has a long history in Oregon and is one of the state's largest employers. We employ nearly 11,000 Oregonians in retail positions and another 800-plus in our Oregon supply and distribution operations. The vast majority of our employees have been unionized for more than six decades and are covered by one of our 56 Oregon labor contracts. I'm a member of the Oregon Bar and have been admitted to a practice before the Oregon Federal Courts and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals since 1977. I specialized in labor law and collective bargaining subject to the provisions of the National Labor Relations Act for my entire career. Safeway has been a client or an employer of mine for nearly 30 years. The reason I'm here today is that House Bill 3339 makes a significant change to the bargaining structure that occurs when unions and employers bargain. And it may not seem like that on the surface. And I testified at the House hearing on this matter, and it was clear to me when I attended that hearing that a significant number of the people who were testifying, and perhaps some of the legislators, did not understand exactly what the bill did. And so what I'd like to do is briefly explain how multi-employer bargaining works and what this bill would do to the multi-employer bargaining process. The typical labor relations arrangement that most people are familiar with is one union negotiating with one employer. And if the parties can't reach an agreement, the union employees may choose to vote to go on strike, which they do by a majority vote of the employees who are covered by the contract. In limited situations, an employer can decide that rather than let the employees go on strike, the employer may choose to lock the employees out. In that situation, you have what's called an offensive lockout. And the term comes from the old days when employers would actually close their gates, put chains on them, padlock the chains so that the employees couldn't get in to go to work. The employees were willing to go to work. The employers wouldn't let them go to work. And those employees were offensively locked out. And when that happens, under Oregon law, as in most other states, employees who are locked out are entitled to unemployment benefits. Now, the situation is a little bit different when the employees withhold their services. If an employer and a union are negotiating and work continues to be available, but the employees choose to strike rather than accept an offer, the employees are choosing to withhold their services. When that happens, unemployment benefits are denied under the existing law. There is an exception that is in the law for the offensive lockouts, as I've mentioned, but there's an exception to the statute that provides that in a multi-employer bargaining situation, employees who are locked out are not eligible for benefits. But it's not in an offensive lockout situation. It's a defensive situation. And to explain the difference between the offensive and defensive situations, I want to give you a fact situation. If I'm a single employer and I have two stores and all of the clerks in my two stores are covered by a single contract and my employees choose to go on strike rather than ratify an offer that I give them, the employees may choose to strike only one of my two stores. And in that situation, I can tell the other employees that they can't work at my other store either. Under Oregon law, in a provision that Bill 3339 is not trying to change, the law says that if you have two locations, they're considered as one for purposes of determining who qualifies for benefits. So if I have employees at one of my stores go on strike, but the employees at my second store are covered by the same contract and also were part of the vote to go on strike, they don't qualify for benefits if I lock them out. I can lock them out defensively, and that is legal, and it is not something that would trigger unemployment benefits because they have the employees at the second store have the same economic interests as the employees at the first store. They're going to gain, presumably, from the results of the strike and the settlement that is reached. Now, federal and Oregon law both provide that employers are not obligated to bargain by themselves. In many industries, employers bargain as a multi-employer group. For example, in Eugene right now, Safeway is in the process of negotiating collective bargaining agreements with its clerks and meat cutters. We're bargaining on a multi-employer basis with Albertsons and Fred Meyer, which is something we've done historically. And we bargain that way throughout the state of Oregon and Southwest Washington as well. Now, in that situation, in a multi-employer scenario, the employers agree to conduct themselves as a single employer. They all make the same offers. All the changes that they negotiate go into all of the contracts together. And the employees are treated as a single group of employees, not three separate groups. And they're all bound to the same offer that gets ratified. So everybody is working as a single group of employers and a single group of employees. Now, employers can't decide to do that on their own. The only way the employers can bargain on a multi-employer basis is if the union agrees at the outset of negotiations that that's the way it's going to be conducted. Now, just for a simple scenario, let's assume that there were just two employers bargaining in this manner. The two employers would make a single offer. The group of employees that would include, let's say, both Safeway and Fred Meyer employees would be treated as one group and would vote as a group on whether or not to ratify the offer. And if they chose not to ratify the offer and go on strike, the strike, by law, would be against Safeway and Fred Meyer, not just Safeway or Fred Meyer, because the employers are bound into a single position, as are the employees. The exception under the unemployment statute, 657-200, says that in that situation, if the union strikes only Safeway, for example, Fred Meyer has the right to lock its employees out defensively, the same as a single employer with two stores would be able to lock the employees out of one store if their other store was struck. That situation has existed for many years and creates a situation where this multi-employer bargaining structure that's permitted and, in fact, encouraged by federal law puts the employers that bargain in that manner in exactly the same position as a single employer with multiple stores would be in. And it's not something, again, that they can do by themselves. The union has to agree to it going in. And when the union agrees to it, the union knows the rules. They know that they're going to get a single offer from all of the employers. They know that the employees are going to vote on that single offer as an entire group, not individually. And they know that if a strike is called, strike against one is a strike against all. And the strike doesn't happen because we lock the people out. The strike happens because the employees vote to withhold their services. And if you eliminate that exception, which is what Bill 3339 is intended to do, it puts employers who try to bargain as a group, which the law encourages, into a situation where they're treated differently by doing that than if they bargain alone. And that situation also would create a situation where, for example, using the Safeway Fred Meyer scenario, if the Fred Meyer employees went on strike and our employees went on strike too, because they have to vote to do that, that we would end up providing unemployment benefits for them that we also pay for, so we would be paying our employees to strike us. Now, for many years, by policy and law, the state of Oregon has remained neutral in labor disputes. Changing this law would create a situation where Oregon would no longer be neutral in labor disputes involving industries that are involved in multi-employer bargaining. The state would still be neutral where it was a single employer, but not where there's multi-employer bargaining. In many industries, including construction and particularly grocery, which is one I've been familiar and worked in for 30 years, have used the multi-employer bargaining structure for many, many, many years. Safeway, Fred Meyer, and Albertsons have been involved in it since the late 1930s. And this provision, if it's passed, would just destroy that relationship. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Erdman, for educating me about something I already clearly understood. Committee members, do you have any questions of this witness before we excuse him? Thank you for coming. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3339. We'll reopen it in just a few moments when we get to it. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2140. Commissioner Gardner, while Ms. Richardson talks about the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2140A makes technical changes to the Public Contracting Code. It exempts certain entities from the Public Contracting Code. It clarifies which projects and contracts of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Department of Aviation, the Department of Housing and Community Services, the Department of Corrections, and the Military Department are subject to the Public Contracting Code. It clarifies that the Director of Department of the Administrative Services has the exclusive authority to procure and supervise procurement of all state agency information technology contracts and all price agreements on behalf of state agencies under which more than one agency may order goods, services, or personal services unless the Director delegates this authority. It provides for emergency procurement of construction services that are not public improvements. It permits contracting or state agency to identify pilot projects for which the agency intends to use an alternate contracting method. You have before you dash A2 amendments that I am sorry to say I don't know much about other than we got them this morning, and they carry forward pieces of House Bill 2944.
And I think the commissioner will be able to share that with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Before you are the dash A2 amendments, which in essence are House Bill 2944 with the dash 16 amendments. This really comes out of an 8.5 month task force, or 8.5 months task force I had on public-private partnerships, which
meaning the dash A2s.
Which someday Mr. Shipwreck and Ms. Harris Adamson will forgive me for having them co-chair for 8.5 months. But really, it comes out of the fact that public-private partnerships have been ballooning all over the state. There's been a lot of difficulty and controversy around them. What we really need to do is have a clear, bright line that everyone can understand, and that's exactly what this bill does. It says exactly what other 31 other states that have a little Davis-Bacon Act or a prevailing wage act does, is that past a certain amount of money, of government money or government investment, that in fact that project is prevailing wage. It also sets the limit at $750,000, which of the 31 other states, there's varying thresholds of limit. Eight states are $1. Fewer, somewhere between $5,000 and $50,000. The highest in the nation is $500,000. This sets the limit at $750,000 on public-private partnerships where government can invest that much of public funds and then becomes a prevailing wage project. There also are other amendments that Mr. Shipwreck worked on. It exempts portions of affordable housing. There's also the Baker City project that became extremely controversial. It really was one that tripped over the line.
That explains, Commissioner, why I have so many people here from Baker County to talk about.
That would be the Baker County contingent.
That must be all of them in the front row.
We put them in, and that exempts that particular project. It's a great project, and really, it's one that really, I wish they'd work with me ahead of time. We could have worked with them, and it perhaps would not have tripped over the line, but it has, and this takes care of that situation. With that, I'd be happy to leave some of the more details to Bob and Jessica.
Okay. So, Bob, you want to take it away?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Bob Shipwreck, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building Trades Council. I'm here this morning to address the A2 amendments.
Is someone going to address the underlying bill? Is that Jessica's job?
Happy to do that. There's also a couple people here from DAS that can.
Okay, great.
Yes.
All right, thank you.
Good point. I'm not going to repeat what the commissioner has already spoken to. We've been working on this issue now for about 18 months.
Is this a consensus amendment out of the work group, or is this the best that we can do out of the work group?
This is a consensus of a number of of a number of groups, there are people who still oppose the A2 amendments or the House Bill 2944.
Okay, but this is a majority of those in the work group, and sometimes people don't come to 100% consensus. Okay.
That's correct.
Okay.
You'll hear from management and labor today. The affordable housing people are here, obviously the folks from Baker and other people who simply would like to get this issue resolved once and for all.
Okay. I'll stop interrupting that.
That's okay. The problem we're trying to deal with here is the Oregon revised statutes. When Mark Hatfield signed the prevailing wage law in 1959, we never heard of public-private partnerships. We just didn't do those things. And so the statutes only really worked for pure upfront public works. The statute says, you know, the use of public funds contracted or carried on by a public agency in the public interest, whatever all that means. There's very little case law surrounding those statutes. So people who want to use the public-private process, which we encourage as well, in fact, we participated in ourselves with some of our pension funds, really have no way to know whether or not the prevailing wage should apply or should not, and this has led to mass confusion situation, and the Baker City is a poster child of why we need to get this law changed so people can understand what the rules are. Senator Morse will recall as well, in October of last year, the commissioner and I were in Ways and Means Committee and were told in no uncertain terms by the members of that committee that they wanted to see a bill this session to correct the problems with the statute, and here it is. Once the task force that the commissioner described, it did not come to a resolution of the problem. I then began trying to work with first the housing people. The problem with this issue that we were trying to deal with is that you have to separate the housing from the commercial, and I'll talk about what we did. So the first thing I did was meet with the affordable housing people to try and get something done there. I literally stumbled upon a California law. The amendments in front of you are closely near what the California legislature did 2 years ago. This problem is not unique to Oregon at all. It's going on all over the country as this type of contracting is utilized. And my counterpart in California said, you know, you ought to take a look at what I did in California. I did. So this is very close to what they did, except I put in a much higher threshold that the commissioner described. In California, the threshold is $1. This bill has it at $750,000 of public funds. Soon after that, the Portland City Council instructed the Portland Development Commission to attempt to resolve this issue on all of those big projects in the Portland area. We met for almost 4 months with the Portland Development Commission. They have adopted by ordinance very, very similar ordinance close to the A2 amendments. What the bill does, it provides a bright standard that, as I tell people, any of us could take a look at a particular project and determine whether prevailing wages should apply or not. On the housing side, what we did is we exempt all affordable housing at 60% of median income or below on rentals, and on ownership, the threshold is 80% of family in median income. These are standard terms used in the industry, so it's a big exemption for housing. The housing advocates maintain that market rate housing should have the Davis-Bacon HUD rates apply. I've included a copy of those HUD rates. Those of you particularly from rural parts of the state, I would encourage you to look at some of these HUD rates. Some of them are below our state minimum wage. On the commercial side, we have an exemption of $750,000 of public funds would trigger it. The public policy issue is that at some point, a certain amount of public funds should trigger prevailing wages. I got that figure actually talking to general contractors who do a lot of this type of work, and they thought that was fair. I'm going to close by just talking about how we determine these. I didn't include this, but we're talking about two different types of wages here on housing. It is the Davis-Bacon HUD rates. We adopted those rates in Oregon. We don't survey in Oregon for housing, just commercial, industrial, and heavy highway. The survey done to get the commercial rates is an annual survey conducted of over 5,000 contractors a year. It's done by the Oregon Employment Department research economists. They look at over 1 million hours of labor performed in the state, and then calculate that. Sometimes it's a union rate, sometimes it is not. It's then published in this book every 6 months, and the public agencies look at it. If you'd like to look at it, it is truly a mix of union and non-union wages. But that's what the prevailing rate is, and that is what the market rate is in this state for contracting. The last thing I just want to mention is I handed out some things. There's a great study here by Peter Cockshaw. Some of you didn't get the memorandum of understanding. This is between the building trades and the affordable housing people to work together collaboratively to improve the working conditions for people on these housing projects. A copy of ballot measure 12, which was a repeal effort in 1994, was soundly rejected in every single county of the state. I did some recent polling, and that 64% figure is still where the public's at. It's actually went up a little bit in the metro area. Peter Cockshaw's study of states that have prevailing wage and don't, and found that he couldn't see any difference in costs of construction. And finally, a study put together by Federal Highway Administration, the only study I've ever seen that actually looks at high or good wages, whatever you want to call it, and productivity. Although Oregon is a relatively high-wage state in highway construction, our costs per mile, actually what it costs to do a mile of asphalt, puts us second lowest in the country. So there's a direct result of good-paying jobs and productivity and cost savings to the public. So I can walk through the amendments if you wish, Madam Chair. I have marked up the bill if you would like me to point out what this does.
Hang on just a second. Senator Cruz has a question.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the objections I have heard at this point to the A2s is that it potentially gives the Commissioner Boley more power. And I, as I'm reading through and looking on page 3, section 34, sub 4, and looking at the change there, I think that's a section that somebody may construe that way. And so I guess I'm looking at the reason for that language.
Could
change.
You tell me which line you're on?
It'd be page 3, starting line 29 and going to page 4 through line 15.
That's current law.
Actually, you're talking about the deleted language?
Yes.
It's just been deleted there and moved to another section of the bill. It's still contained within the bill. It's a reorganization by legislative council. It does not actually take that out permanently. It just takes it out of that section and sets it to another section. The controls are still there.
Okay. Madam Chair, I've heard some objections. I'm supporting this. I've heard some objections. I'm just trying to be able to answer those objections. So I'm looking for hidden things at this point.
Well,
so.
Senator Cruz, maybe we just didn't understand the bill.
Actually,
previous witness testified. So.
It's on page 8, line 26, puts it back in.
Okay. Thank you.
I get irritated when someone tells me I don't know how to do my job, but that's another comment. So Thank you. And Dana, Ms. Richardson is getting a copy of the staff major summary on House Bill 2944. That passed the House by a pretty substantial number of votes, correct?
40 yes votes, Madam Chair, yes.
40 yes votes. Okay. I thought so. So we're doing all right here. Okay. So does anyone on the committee need Mr. Shipwreck to go through the A2 amendments in detail? We got briefed on this
yesterday
in our own caucus, so I think we're good, unless Senator, okay, they're fine. Okay, Ms. Adamson, why don't you tell us what you'd like to say?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors. First to the underlying bill, House Bill 2140A, is a technical cleanup to the public contracting code. As you may recall, 4 years ago, we had a bill that completely revamped the public contracting code in Oregon to GORS 279 and split it up into three parts, 279A, which is the overarching section of statute that deals with all public contracts, 279B, that's primarily for purchasing goods and services, and 279C, we lack because it's C for construction and construction-related contracts. Be first contractors to remember. And in that rewrite, as with any major change in statute, you're going to find things over the next few sessions that, you know, we really ought to make an adjustment here, we ought to really clean this up there. And the Department of Justice, DAS, and other public contracting types spend time in the interim looking for what is it that we missed, what should be cleaned up, what can we make better. And this really represents a non-controversial consensus bill dealing with those cleanup provisions. Some of the highlights of the bill include on page 12, starting at line 35, section 6A, talks about emergency procurements. Construction folks have always been, when we had 1279, didn't particularly matter what section we were had procurements under. When we split it and we had 279C procurements, 279C procurements are based upon low competitive bid. And so that works great when you have time, but when a water main breaks in the middle of the night, you don't have time to let out a bid and get proposals back. You need somebody out there, and you need them out there now. Such is the nature of emergency procurements. Those procurements are handled better under 279B than they are under 279C. We made an amendment in the House that clarifies that if you do have time, not all emergencies are middle of the night water main breaking. Some emergencies are a landslide and you've got a couple of days to, because you're going to have a big cleanup effort, Highway 35, for example, being a good example this last winter. You have a couple of days to make a decision about who is that you're going to hire. Under those circumstances, what this language says is we want you to take your time as appropriate and use as much competitive bidding as you possibly can under the circumstances. In other words, don't just throw it away and call whoever your favorite contractor is. Use some competition as appropriate under the circumstances. And we think that improves that and also makes it easier for agencies to administer. The other two sets of changes that are were significant deal with public improvement alternative contracting processes. This law states that if you go out and you're wanting to build a school, for example, the process is you get an architect, you design it, and then you send it out for bid, and you award to the lowest responsive, which means they got everything in on time, responsible, which means they have a satisfactory record of integrity and performance, bidder. So it's essentially low bid. Now, you can't evaluate them based upon the other things that they bring to the table in terms of timing and scheduling and those kinds of things. I know this is really an exciting section of law, but the alternative contracting process requires, in order to use something like an RFP, you have to make findings, and those findings include that you won't substantially reduce or diminish competition. It won't encourage favoritism. And the current law says it will result in substantial cost savings to the agency. The idea being you don't just use it because you think it's neat. You've got to make sure that it's going to result in some good things. The problem that agencies are finding is saying that it will result in cost savings is like saying it will be sunny on Memorial Day. While our fine weather people can say we expect it to be, which is about the same thing as what our findings people say, they will expect it to reduce result in cost savings. They cannot assure it because you don't know what's going to happen to material prices or anything else. You can't know today what is going to happen at the end of a project that's maybe 2 or 3 years away from completion. So what they want to be able to say and what we've agreed to is that it will likely result in substantial cost savings to the contracting agency based upon justification and information described in statute. So they're going to have to make some findings. They're going to have to do some justifying. But they aren't going to have to give a hard, firm answer. The last thing this does is if they're using an alternative process that they've never used before and they don't know whether or not it will result in cost savings, they're allowed to do it once without having to make those findings. And if it turns out to be a disaster, then they're going to have to make a solid finding the next time. We've been assured by the Department of Justice that they'll write some pretty hefty rules around that, and they have in the past done a good job of that. Other than that, this bill goes through and makes a series of cleanups, clarifies some language, and is overall a good bill that will improve the public contracting process. It's something that we all spend quite a bit of time on in the interim, and again, has no opposition. For AGC's part, the Dash 2 amendments represent an important public policy for Oregon. Right now, there's a great deal of uncertainty in the development world. There is not a bright line, and while predeterminations occur for contractors, the reality is we aren't involved with those decisions up front. We aren't the ones negotiating the deal between the developer and the agency or whoever it is that are working out these financing arrangements. We're on the front lines building these projects. And if there has been a predetermination but the development agreement was changed, or they didn't get a predetermination agreement at all and just assumed everything would be fine and move forward because no one really understands the line, we're the ones at the back end facing a problem. Because if wages are owed, if it should have been prevailed and it wasn't, and wages are owed, we are joint and severably liable for those wages, even though we had no idea. And so for contractors, it is a very tenuous place to be. We want certainty. We aren't opposed to prevailing wage. My union, Open Shop Contractors, believe if you're gonna have public involvement, you know, prevailing wage is appropriate. Make sure that it's clear and it's fair, and we'll pay it. So it's not in opposition to prevailing wage, but we do want to know what the rules are up front, and we want those rules to be clear and fairly applied. These are clear. We believe they can be fairly applied. We believe that it will result in certainty and clarify much of this dispute today with a law that wasn't designed to deal with these kinds of projects. This bill finally modernizes the statute for the kinds of projects we're seeing today. And so we would strongly encourage you to adopt the Dash 2 amendment and to maintain additionally the current language in House Bill 2140 that, again, we believe represents some important cleanup to the current law.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Adamson, for that explanation. And I think Senator Morris has a clarifying question. This committee is liking this bill. We want to hear from people, but we're not going to hear a lot of time from folks because I think you're all taken care of in Baker City. But Senator Morris?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate the opportunity to ask this question. And it deals with the financing issue. If a private entity is, and I'm referencing page 4, essentially lines 23 through 29, if a private entity utilizes revenue bonds, how would that apply to the 700, or how would the $750,000 threshold apply in the event of that kind of financing?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Morse, Bob Shiprock again. Some of the revenue bonds already would have, I talked in discussions with the Treasurer's Office, some already come with prevailing wage where they're used for public improvements. And in fact, the bill says that on certain programs, if they are used for public improvements, then the 750 applies. There is an exemption of one program in here called the Oregon Facilities Authority, which I really didn't even know existed, that funds some independent colleges, hospitals, things like that. Quick answer to your question. Under the bill, revenue bonds that exceed $750,000, those are public funds, would fall under the purview of the bill.
Does that answer your question?
Well, I guess this question may be a little bit esoteric. Is it the gross value of the bonds, or is it the differential between the public benefit derived by using public funding versus commercial funding? And that's really my question, Madam Chair. It's kind of a fine point, but it could be a significant point.
I understand, Madam Chair, the question, and it is the first scenario. It is the $750,000 of the gross amount. Yes.
Okay. Now are you your
Thank
question
you,
answered?
Chair.
Okay, great. Senator Cruz has a clarifying question.
Yeah.
Mr. Shiprock, maybe you can answer it.
The A2s have an emergency clause, and yet I've never seen this before, and maybe I just haven't paid enough attention, but on the first page, line 4 of the A2s, it adds and declare an emergency to basically line 7 of the bill. Why does it do that?
Chair Walker,
committee administrator has an answer.
Oh, she does?
Whenever there's one at the end, it includes at the beginning with the statutes that are being changed.
Okay, I just haven't paid enough attention. I'm new at this. So
that particular one is confusing.
Okay.
I think we got the question. Okay, thank you both very much. I need to hear from the people on the underlying bill because they were a little bit nervous in the back.
Underlying bill people are always nervous.
Yeah. Diane Lancaster and Bill Nestle. Come on up. Let's make this quick. We really need to get to our other bill. I'm going to give this bill another 10 minutes and that's it.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Bill Nestle with the Oregon Department of Justice. With me is Diane Lancaster, the Chief Procurement Officer with the Department of Administrative Services. I don't think there's much I could do to improve on Jessica Adamson's description of the main
features
of the
bill.
And so I'm not going to go into that. We do have written testimony. We came here today speaking on behalf of the Department of Justice and the Department of Administrative Services about a non-controversial, unanimously passed in the House housekeeping measure.
And I know. And
so the only concern that we have now is that we haven't seen the public-private partnership amendments. We are hoping that they are no more than add-ons that won't get into the guts of the bill. And the Department of Justice might be willing to be neutral if we had some kind of comfort that this House concurrence requirements that are now being tacked on.
Well, I appreciate that from the department. At this point, it's a little bit out of the department's hands.
Sure.
But House Bill 2944 did pass the House by a significant margin, and they've made the accommodation for Baker City, and we'll have them come up in a moment. So I think we're all good to go. So, Ms. Lancaster, do you have anything else to add?
Senator Walker, members of the committee, for the record, Diane Lancaster, Department of Administrative Services. I don't have anything to add at this point, and we'll, of course, look at the Dash 2 amendments and let the committee know if there are any issues.
Okay, great. Thank you. We'll look at your written testimony. Okay, now 7 people came from Baker County. I appreciate the turnout. But are there just a couple of you that could speak? I'll take 3. if you want to come up. And you know, were any of you here yesterday where they discussed the dash 16s? So the dash 16s are in the A2s, or the in our A2s. So tell me what happened yesterday, if you're comfortable with what we've got.
We went to the 2944 yesterday.
That's what I mean.
Okay, and they postponed ours. They didn't talk about ours.
They didn't talk about yours, but the amendment is in here.
Yes.
So can you speak to that piece, why it's important to you?
Yes.
Our amendment? Oh, yes.
Yeah. I know it's a little confusing this morning, but that's okay.
Senator Cruz.
That would be good to start out with who you are. Thank you.
I'm a fundraiser and project director for the Carnegie Arts and Cultural Center project. And
great.
And this is Terry Axness, who's the board chair for Crossroads Art Center, and Dan Moore, who's on the board and the former board chair.
Okay.
And then these are all board members from Crossroads.
And thank you all for coming. I hope you carpooled. That's a long drive.
We're testifying in support of House Bill 2140, the dash A amendments, specifically the language on page 5, lines 8 through 16. Which the purpose of that is to correct a situation that was very recently brought to our attention. Crossroads Art Center is a small, 44-year-old nonprofit, a 501c3 with an annual budget of $75,000. It's run by more than 100 volunteers and one part-time paid director, and serves our remote Eastern Oregon county of 16,000 people, with an emphasis on serving underprivileged children and families. In 2000, the city of Baker City and Crossroads started talking about using the abandoned Carnegie building to be Crossroads' home, because Crossroads had a tough time affording any rental locations and had been without a home for many years. From the beginning, the city told Crossroads this is a Crossroads project and the city would not be involved. The city gave Crossroads a lease that had an indefinite number of 30-year renewals, and it didn't contain any construction language. Crossroads took the lease and added the construction language to guarantee it had permission to do the renovations it needed to do the building. Then in 2002, the city, Crossroads, and the general contractor proceeded with the understanding it was not a prevailing wage job. The city attorney did study the law at the time, but as has been stated this morning, it must have been confusing for him, and he thought this isn't prevailing wage because it's not a city project, it's a Crossroads project.
Okay.
So we didn't think it was prevailing wage.
So we didn't think it was prevailing wage.
We were told it wasn't. Yeah. It would not be a prevailing wage project.
And then okay. And you're, when you speak, you got to let us know.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Again, in the record.
Terry, I'm Terry Axness, board chair.
Okay, great.
So this year is a requirement for a final grant, a SCIF fund grant.
Mm-hmm.
They had us write to Bowley to get that confirmation. And Bowley wrote back in February 2007 and said, this is a prevailing wage job.
Mm-hmm.
We all said, oh, my God. So Crossroads, Baker City, and the general contractor, we have no quarrel with Bowley. We can understand how they've reached that interpretation mm-hmm. from the lease. But we've raised more than $1 million from our local community and funding sources to complete the project. And as a small rural community, we've exhausted our revenue sources. We've gone to every foundation in the state that's given to this project. You know, Meyer, Murdoch in Vancouver. If the amendment's not passed, the project will not be completed as planned. And with this amendment, we can ask for the final grant funds, and which have been restricted, to finish the project and be in the building by July.
Great.
When completed, this project will give Crossroads the sustainability to broaden its programs to benefit the entire community. It's been an integral part of economic development for Baker County for the last few years. So we're asking for support of the dash two amendments to this bill, because it will give Crossroads Art Center to the ability to complete its mission to create opportunities for the entire community to be engaged, inspired, and transformed by the arts through participation in classes, workshops, exhibits, mentorships, and partnerships, to be a welcoming place where the public meets and the arts speak.
Fantastic. Do you have some written testimony you can leave with us? That'd be great, because whoever's carrying this bill might want to be talking about that little piece of it. Mr. Moore, did you have anything else you wanted to add? Just ditto?
No, just ditto. Thank
you. Okay. Again, thank you all for making the effort and for this project. I'm glad we can keep it moving. This bill is really necessary in order to do that. I appreciate you understand what the commissioner was under.
Yes, we do.
In making his ruling. So, questions?
Just
Senator Westland?
A comment, Madam Chair, and echo some of your remarks. First of all, thank you for making the long drive. You know, I've driven to Baker City and back many times, and it's an interesting drive. But more than that, just your continued commitment and your persistence in trying to move, you know, a heartfelt passion of yours forward and support arts and culture in your community, all that goes into that. I just very much thank and compliment each and every one of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
All right. Hearing nothing else from my committee, thank you so much.
Yes.
Okay. I will now hear from just a couple more people. Let's see. Ms. Richardson from the Treasurer's Office sent me up a note. I'm also going to hear from Phil Donovan. Sophia McDonald was signed up to testify in the first panel. Were you? Do you need to speak? I think it was taken care of. Okay, would you come up? And Mr. Mannix, I know you're there. You'll come last because you came in last. So, okay. So if you three will just go briefly, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Kate Cooper-Richardson, Chief of Staff for the State Treasurer. I'm sorry if my testimony will be a little scattered here. We just were made aware of the -2s. They are, though, we have been working on the -16s to 2944, so we were aware of them then. I did want to make the committee aware of a policy change that will occur under this. As many of you are aware, the state has a number of state bond loan programs, and this will be an expansion of the prevailing wage to reach those programs. We don't consider them, and they haven't been considered in the past, public-private partnerships. There are loans that go to, like, for instance, through the small-scale energy loan projects, go to private entities. There are loans through, for instance, the Department of Energy to a private entity. They're repaid with private money, and they're a private project, not for public use. The change of the definition of public works will expand to those if they're over $750,000. And so that will be a change of policy. There is, as Mr. Shiprack noted, there is an exemption for the Oregon Facilities Authority, which does conduit revenue bonds for tax-exempt financing for many nonprofits. There is that exemption, and we are glad that's housed in the Treasurer's office. We do work with, however, all the state bond programs and do believe, and the Treasurer believes, that the principle is the same to those other bond projects. I wasn't prepared for a written testimony, but I've made a few changes on the one for 2944, and I will give you a list of those. But right now, just to put in the record, Veterans Affairs, Water Resources Department, Housing and Community Services, Department of Energy, Office of Emergency Management for Seismic Rehabilitation of Emergency Services Buildings, and Economic and Community Development all have loan or grant programs. The Treasurer has been supporting an amendment that more broadly reaches loans, and not necessarily grants, but loans to private entities if the projects are entirely to a private entity. However, we are glad to see the exemption in this bill here for Oregon Facilities Authority, and you will note, too, at the back of the A2 amendments, in the end of Section 7, on page 13, that there is an amendment that exempt projects that are already in process, because as soon as we became aware of this issue arising, there are projects that have already been sized, and we're going out to sell the bonds right now, and it would have impacted those current projects. Projects like that going forward will be subject to prevailing wage. So I wanted to make the committee aware of that policy change.
Okay. Question?
How big is this impact going to be?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, we're actually not sure. We believe it will be a chilling effect, as you know, many of these smaller projects, and $750,000 is, we believe, not a very high threshold.
I would agree.
A lot of our smaller projects, for instance, the Facilities Authority, but some of these other programs have a Bond Express program or small projects, but those are in the neighborhood of $1.5-2 million, so they would be captured. The margin for a private contractor, and I'm going to be speaking out of my element a little bit here, though, can be very close. It's our belief and that of our debt management director that the difference here will be enough that they won't access this program. So they'll either go to a private lender and increase their costs that way, but the margin between the lower rate and the increased cost from turning this into a public works project would make the difference.
I think we'll probably have Mr. Chappell and Ms. Adamson come up in response in a few minutes about that.
And I did want to make the committee aware of one other practical implementation problem that we see, too, that with some of these programs, the only contract with the public entity are the financing agreements. And should these projects become public works projects, the financing agreement may become a de facto contract for public works, which brings a lot of problems as far as implementation, what to include in them, and also some timing issues. Sometimes these financings are takeout financing, so it's at the end of a project, not at the beginning. So we wanted to flag for the committee that we do think there are some practical issues that will need to be worked out with DOJ as far as putting those changes in place, and that it is a policy change regarding these programs that have not been considered public-private partnerships in the past.
I want to thank Ms. Richardson for that. I wasn't aware of that implication in this. That is significant.
Okay. Well, we'll have some response to that. Ms. McDonald, can you be very brief, please?
Yes, absolutely. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sophia McDonald. I represent the Association of Oregon Community Development Organizations. We represent 32 community development corporations across the state of Oregon. These are private nonprofit developers of affordable housing. Our organization, along with our sister organization, the Community Development Network in Portland, were the ones who worked with the Oregon Building Trades Council to negotiate the portion of the agreement that you see in here regarding affordable housing. We are here today to support House Bill 2140, which will provide clarity to our affordable housing developers on when they need to pay prevailing wages and when they do not. You've heard from the contractors that this uncertainty has caused a lot of problems. It's caused a lot of problems for our developers as well. We would be very pleased to answer any questions from the committee or give you any more information at a later date if you would like that. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. And Mr. Donovan, you probably have the same issue to speak to.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, I do. Phil Donovan, on behalf of the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities, I'm here to support the A2s to House Bill 2140. As soon as I revamp my one-pager to reflect the new bill number, I'll get you some written materials and support.
Well, you could just handwrite it on.
That's what I did. What I wanted to share with you is a couple of things very briefly. First off, I want to thank the proponents of the legislation who took a lot of time and energy to understand the unique financial arrangements that are made to develop affordable housing. So after Sophia got done working over Bob Shiprack, then we got our clamps into him. And I want to go on the record and say, you may hear that a desire for more expansive definition of affordable housing, and we've talked about that, but as you know, in the legislative process, you don't get everything that you want. We frankly got to a place that works. So we strongly urge you to pass this bill. This is a good step forward for affordable housing. And just for the record, we're supportive of paying good wages and health benefits on our jobs. Housing authorities are not profit-driven. We are not a taxing authority. Our interest is to help low-income Oregonians. And passage of this legislation is going to help enable that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you. I appreciate it. Ms. Richardson, don't go away, though. You step back.
Just joined me. So
okay, good.
Help.
Okay, Mr. Mannix, come up, and then Ms. Adamson and Mr. Shipwreck, I want you to be able to respond to the issues that Ms. Richardson raised. And I'm closing this hearing at 9:15. So, Mr. Mannix, you're not taking a lot of time here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Mannix. I'm an attorney in Salem and a former member of the House and a former member of the Senate. Haste makes waste. I'm here today only to talk about the Dash 2 amendments and the effort to add House Bill 2944 to this bill. You were told that it passed by a vote of 40 in the House, but did anyone mention that actually the vote hovered at 31 with two Democrats voting no But two Republicans voted yes, and when it hit 31, nine people in the back of the room who didn't want to be voting against affordable housing came forward to vote yes, so it got 40 votes. You are adding to a nice little train, House Bill 2140, a caboose which is laden with a nuclear bomb called House Bill 2944, which is not a consensus piece. Where is the Department of Housing and Community Services? Where is the Department of Administrative Services? Where is the Oregon Department of Transportation that are not in the room here today, and they were not in the room last week in front of the Commerce Committee? When I raised a question about the housing amendments that were put on the cutting room floor in the House Committee, and where I pointed out that the bright line that is going to be painted by House Bill 2944, now to be added to this bill, simply hands the commissioner full rulemaking authority, gives him the bucket and the paint and the brush, and says, go out there and write some rules and figure it out, and then that will be our bright line. Because this bill greatly expands the reach of prevailing wage into the private sector, and then it grants exemptions, largely dependent on rules to be written by the commissioner, which will now have to be emergency rules, because this bill, I haven't seen the Dash 2 amendments, but I understand they still have that emergency clause in there. And by the way, that means it goes into effect July 1st in 6 weeks. There's some great calamity about to strike this state that allows the commissioner to write emergency rules under an emergency clause for a bill which didn't have the votes yesterday to get out of the Commerce Committee. I invite you to ask Senator Monroe and Senator Avakian and Senator Gordley what concerns they had that caused them to say that bill could not go out without certain amendments, including, as I understood it, the A-19 amendments, which did draw a bright line. At the same time, these fine folks from Baker City were told, well, the bill's been set over to May 30th. It's good that they stayed, and someone was kind enough to tell them that the necessary exemption they need, which could be added as a caboose to this train and take care of their need, they're here today to talk about that. But where is Metro to talk about all the problems they're going to have with this bill and the A2 versions? So all I can say in a short time is haste makes waste. This nice train, 2140, which seems to have consensus support, and the Baker City amendments are about to have a nuclear bomb placed in that caboose, and it consists of a bill which does incredible things to prevailing wage in this state without careful debate and discernment. And I would mention one analogy. In workers' compensation, we learned over the years, when you're going to do something in a complex area like this, you take it to the Labor Management Committee. The legislature's always been careful to say we need a group of people who really are into the details to work on this stuff. And then the legislature will look at it. I invite you to insist that this material go to an interim group that isn't set up by the commissioner, but is set up by the legislature. I invite you to insist that there be no emergency clause on whatever you do, because it's going to take time to implement. And I respectfully encourage you to take a very careful look at the views of folks who are not here today.
Thank you, Mr. Mannix. I appreciate it. Jessica and Bob, can you come back up? Can you respond to Ms. Richardson's comments, and are we going to be okay with this Dash A2 and the issues she raised?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors. The problems related to the treasurer's statements are the creation of really kind of two different policies happening at the same time. A year and a half ago, after really a year's worth of public process, the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee, which is a statutory creation made up of labor management, local government, and economic development folks dealing with prevailing wage issues, advising the commissioner. We agreed and supported a change in rule dealing with conduit financing. This is after a situation in which a public agency through an alumni association issued revenue bonds, built what everyone considered to be a public works project, but by simply the nature of the bonds and the way it worked, wouldn't have been prevailing wage. There was a unanimous agreement that that should have been prevailed and didn't. To address that situation, we passed a rule including conduit financing and revenue bonds as public funds. So that's a rule, not a statute. That rule, as we were working on this bill, trips that rule. those funds, because we have a two-part test in Oregon, those funds would never have touched, just because those were called public funds, those funds would never have affected private projects before. Bob and I both agree that rule needs to be revisited in light of this legislation. That rule will bring in programs that we didn't intend to bring in, that happened to be brought in as a result of this bill. And so we, as two members of the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee, believe that it's time to revisit that rule. We will work towards that end, looking at these programs individually, looking at the specific issue that you've raised, Senator Morse, regarding the difference between the actual net public benefit, which is the difference between what would you pay at the prime rate versus what are you paying at the state rate. Is that the 6% difference, and what is that amount, and looking at that amount against the $750,000 threshold instead of what's the total amount of bonds, because that's the true, from AGC standpoint, that's the true net public benefit. So I think for our part, and I'll let Mr. Shiprock say his piece as well, we believe that that rule needs immediate work to address this issue. It doesn't require statutory intervention here because it is a rule that's causing the issue, not the statute.
Okay, and you're both on that advisory committee, so we do have lots of input here. Mr. Shiprock, you are not in agreement, though
Madam
we can't
Chair,
record
Bob,
nods.
Madam Chair, Bob Shiprock, Oregon Building Trades, and for the record, I wholeheartedly agree with Jessica. This thing keeps evolving. There are programs out there, frankly, Madam Chair, I did not know existed. We have a state bank is what we've got here, and a whole bunch of programs that I think we go through one by one, sort them out. What do they do? What is the public purpose?
Well, I think in your initial testimony, I'm going to go back because I've got several pages of notes here, but you said that in 1989, when the statute was created, we didn't know about public-private partnerships.
It's actually 59.
Oh, 59.
Yes.
I heard the 8. Well, there you go. So here we are continuing to evolve. That's why it's in rule. You can immediately address it. I think Senator Morse has a question, and I hear Senator Cruz's
size,
so I know there's a question in there.
we need to move on, but I would like to just state for the record that the difference between net and gross, if you're talking about 300 basis points, is $22,500 of net public benefit when the intent is $750,000. That's a huge difference, and Ms. Richardson's comment that it would have a chilling effect on the utilization of these public funded programs that are interest rate, that's what we're talking about in terms of public benefit. This is something that is very important and needs to be addressed. Thank you.
And I think they've indicated they would address it, and we don't need a statutory fix.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not convinced of that at this point, simply because of what Ms. Richardson said, that this bill will impact that, and so if the legislation impacts it, I'm not sure that rule is necessarily the appropriate remedy, and it would be interesting to find out from these agencies what they think the impact will be. I'm not comfortable with expanding prevailing wage into loan programs that have not been part of prevailing wage before.
Okay. Senator Metzger?
Either one of you, I'd like to have you respond to Mr. Mannix's comment specifically on the -A2 in terms of the emergency clause, because it does have rulemaking authority for the commissioner. It does take place July 1. And to respond to Mr. Mannix's concerns, or whether you have any concerns about emergency rules, which obviously you won't be participating in great detail because that's only 60 days or less than 60 days away, is that a concern of yours at all?
Chair Walker, Senator Metzger, the rulemaking authority that is in the -2 amendment clarifies the authority that the commissioner already has. He already has authority to write rules under 279 for the prevailing wage
statute. So the answer is no concern of record?
No.
Okay.
No,
Bob, is that the same with you?
Madam Chair, Senator Metzger, that's correct. The commissioner already has that authority. We wanted to put it in the statute, frankly, because there are some very small things that we want to, that shouldn't go in a statute. Frankly, and I just want to make two very important points. This, the A2 amendments restrict the commissioner's broad authority by putting this stuff in statute. Much of what you see in the A2s generally would have went in rules. Why is there an emergency clause? As I said, the City of Portland and the Portland Development Commission have already adopted this by ordinance. They have no statutory underpinnings for their ordinance. Hence, they need the emergency clause to implement this so that there is a chaos in the Portland area.
Which... we don't want chaos. They already generate enough of their own.
I don't either.
Okay, so any other questions? All right, then I'm going to close the public hearing.
I'll make the motion. I'm not comfortable, but I think if you got the votes, do it.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want me to go into work session?
Do we not need amendments then further?
No.
Okay.
We have the dash A2, and then we have the understanding that this question raised by Ms. Richardson would be in rule.
In rule, okay.
I think the only proviso, if I may, Madam Chair, add is that we haven't checked the dash 2s for conflicts, but I'm kind of getting the signal from committee staff and commerce that we shouldn't have any conflicts with other bills out there.
Okay. Well, all right.
I guess I'm just kind of wanted you to be aware of it, but I don't think
I can,
it should hold you up.
I can hold this till we're going to go till 10:15 today. I can hold this until 10:10 if you like. If you need time to go check that, I don't know that they can run conflicts that quickly.
They're pretty amazing.
Okay. Why don't I just close the public hearing and then we'll reopen the work session a little bit later after we get that verified. Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2140. We are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3339 again. I am not going to hear HJM 13 today. We just simply do not have time. I'll carry that over to next week. I don't think there's an emergency regarding that bill anyway, so we will get to it next week. We already had information from the committee administrator on what this bill does. We heard... from one party already. Let's see. Representative Witt in the back. Come on up. You were out of the room. We took Steve Erdman. Well, it isn't the way it's written on here, and he wrote it. But we took him out of order. He was from Safeway. I'm sure you heard from him on the House side. And he came. He came to educate us about what we didn't know and you didn't know.
All right.
So, go ahead. Introduce yourself and take it away.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Brad Witt, State Representative from House District 31, which is the extreme northwest corner of our great state. And certainly appreciate the opportunity to appear before you this morning to testify in favor of House Bill 3339. And presuming from earlier testimony that you've heard about strikes and lockouts and the contrast between the two of them, I'd like to try and place those briefly in a little bit of a context. And to do so, it's necessary to talk about briefly federal law, which establishes collective bargaining between labor and management in the private sector, and then state unemployment insurance, again, briefly. The National Labor Relations Act, as amended, at least in theory, has tried for the past 70 years to balance power relationships in collective bargaining between unions and companies. And in the instances where either labor or management chooses to take economic action against the other party, it is that moving party that suffers the consequences of its economic action, and that's the balance that 70 years of history has tried to implement. For instance, if the union strikes, it suffers the consequences of the company's right to hire replacement workers, otherwise known as strike breakers. Conversely, if the company locks out its workers, the company then suffers the consequences of an inability to continue to staff its operations. It can't hire replacement workers. It's made the decision for a lockout. A lockout is a lockout is a lockout. Now, enter state unemployment insurance. How does it balance strikes and lockouts? If I decide to strike, I have made myself unavailable for work, and I suffer the consequences. I am therefore ineligible for unemployment insurance benefits. However, if I'm locked out, if my employer decides to lock me out, I am otherwise ready, willing, and able to go to work, and my employer has denied me that opportunity. What are the consequences? Well, the answer is it depends. If this is a single employer contract or lockout, I probably qualify for unemployment insurance. My employer has denied me that opportunity to work. If, however, it is a multi-employer situation, then the answer is probably not. Action consequences. Now, I think the action and the consequences in the single employer instance is appropriate. I will tell you that in the multi-employer situation, I believe it is inappropriate, and I have no good answer for you why that situation is as it currently exists in state statute. Consider, first of all, that if I am locked out by my employer in a multi-employer situation, I do not have a labor dispute with the employer that I am. I do not have, in essence, a beef with the employer who's decided to lock me out. In the instance, I think that you probably heard from the grocery industry, I've been locked out because employers made an independent decision. In addition, in a multi-employer situation, what are the consequences? The employer has initiated the action. Who suffers the consequences? The employees do. That is completely out of balance with the rest of state unemployment insurance law, as well as federal law's attempts to provide that power relationship balance. It is further untenable in that impasse has to be reached before either the strike or the lockout can be initiated. By definition, impasse means that collective bargaining has terminated, has to have. Now, the arguments that some have put forward is, well, a strike by one is a strike by all. That is simply not true. The multi-employer's bargaining arrangement is established by choice of the employers and the unions. It is simply easier to engage in one set of negotiations for both parties than it is to go through repeated negotiations over and over and over again, company by company by company. That impasse terminates the collective bargaining. Any decision that's made after the bargaining phase, we are now in impasse, whether it is a strike on the one hand or a lockout on the other, is a decision that is made by that independent party, independent of any other party's bearing, coming to bear on that. If we are to consider action and consequences, then this should be balanced as well in this instance. In a multi-employer situation, just like a single-employer situation, The action of a lockout, of denying someone who is ready, willing, and able to go to work should mean that that individual should otherwise be entitled to receive unemployment insurance benefits. Madam Chair, members of the committee, with that concludes my testimony. If you have questions, I would be more than happy to attempt to answer them. I am not an attorney, but I would do my best. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Witt. I think you just answered the comment of Mr. Erdman or Erdem, who said that, you know, in the multi-employer lockout, the employees and the employer agree to work under that arrangement. But it seems to me the balance is really tipped towards the employer then, when one of the stores, which is a separate contract, you're all under one big umbrella, but you're negotiating separate contracts, and so one of the stores decides it's not going to work for them, and so they shut out all the others?
Well, Madam Chair, that is precisely the inequity that I have tried to describe here in my testimony. And the agreement that we will bargain together, multi-employers and either one union, or it could be multi-unions that agree to bargain together. It is for the purposes of the collective bargaining. That collective bargaining, when it comes to an end, when an impasse, which again is a legal term, when there is no ability to make further advancement in the negotiations process, neither party feels that they can move forward, impasse has been reached, that collective bargaining is terminated by definition.
That's the key. Okay, any other questions of Representative Witt? Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is in an area that I'm not really all that familiar with, but are rolling strikes utilized in multi-employer bargaining when you do come to an impasse?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, certainly that is a weapon that's available. Just like the lockout is available, there could be an instance where a lockout was initiated just against the employees of one company. In the instance where there may be multi-unions involved, one union may be locked out, another may not. The choices of utilization of that weapon are a matter at that point of strategy. And you know, when you get to the point where you're utilizing economic action, it's probably where you can use the greatest lever and by the same token yourself not suffer, minimize your own economic consequences. What do I mean in this regard? Personally, I think it is a mistake strategically for a union in a multi-employer situation to strike all employers. I recognize that I may even be in the minority among people in the labor movement. Some folks feel that more economic advantage is gained by striking everybody at once. That may be true for some unions. In my experience, first of all, if I strike an entire industry, I'm probably going to suffer bigger consequences in terms of I have a lot more union members out on strike. Secondly, I probably am trying to accomplish specific ends with a specific employer. And thirdly, I don't think I do any favor to the general consuming public, be it either a good or service, in denying the public an opportunity to purchase that good or service someplace. If we've shut an entire industry down, I think we've done a disservice to the public. And so my reasoning there may be entirely different from somebody else's, but the options and opportunities are as varied as the circumstances that surround that particular set of negotiations.
As a follow-up,
mm-hmm.
How often is a rolling strike used if in a multi-employer situation where one store, one employer, and then it moves to the next, and then the next, and the next, and it just rotates?
I think, Madam Chair, Senator Morse, very infrequently, I'm usually after a dispute occurs, when there's resolution of that initial dispute, I think everybody tends to see the wisdom of that particular settlement, and typically negotiations or the agreement rather tends to fall in line at that point. And I honestly would be I don't know when the last rolling strike was like that.
I don't remember one in my community for a long time.
Yeah.
Okay, any other questions of Representative Witt? Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very
on.
Much.
Yeah, I'm going to hear from three other labor folks, and then I'll hear from the opponents, and then finish it up with two other labor people. So Art Towers, Elizabeth Kushwa, and Duke Shepherd.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Kushwa, and I'm here today on behalf of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 555. Excuse me. I do have written testimony. I have had a chance to talk to you, at least some of you, briefly about this. What this law is about fairness. And you heard from Mr. Erdman that this would significantly change the bargaining process. He was absolutely right. You would change it, and it would be fair. He also said the employees would choose to withhold their services. And I think we have to talk a little bit about what this is and what decisions are made. I think you all have a pretty good grasp of what is happening here. I think what you need to understand is that two decisions are being made. The first decision that's being made is for the union to vote to authorize a strike for members working for one company. They are not voting to strike. They are voting to authorize a strike. For whatever reason, Company A has done, for whatever reason, the union decides to strike Company A. Misbehavior, contract issues, whatever. Companies B and C then lock out their workers. So the first decision is to vote to authorize a strike. And that is just a simple majority vote. The second decision that's made is by each individual worker working for Company A to choose whether or not he or she wants to go to work. He can say, you know what, I need the money, I need this job, I'm going. Or he can choose to honor the strike. We are not asking for striking workers to receive unemployment insurance. That's a decision that they've made, and they choose to do it. Companies B and C then lock out their workers. Each individual worker in those companies is not given the choice to go to work or not. They are also not given the choice to have unemployment insurance or not. So it's kind of a codified double jeopardy situation. Sorry, we won't let you work. Sorry, we won't give you unemployment insurance. I also have to believe that it's some sort of a de facto government support of this tactic to break a strike or union, because what it does is say, okay, you know, you have no recourse here at all. I have spoken to people from the employment department who have stated that the trust fund is in great shape, and that even a lockout of over a month would not increase the employer's contribution to the trust fund. And frankly, if they're locking out people's work, people from working. It's their choice to have that happen. I believe that's pretty much the crux of what's going on. I also want to say, and you'll hear from other people too, that you're dealing with separate contracts here. Yes, they're the same terms, but with few exceptions, and there are some exceptions, but with few exceptions, they're separate contracts because they're separate companies. It's not a conglomerate, which with different arms. You're dealing with three separate companies. And so the idea of this is just the idea of returning fairness to the process. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Kushwa, and I appreciate you didn't read your testimony. You're much more effective summarizing it and speaking to us.
Good.
I appreciate that.
Good.
Okay, who wants to go next?
All right. Chair Walker, members of the committee, Duke Shepherd with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We're a federation representing about 100,000 working Oregonians and retirees around the state, and in terms of this bill's applications, the longshore workers are in our federation, and they would be the ones that we're here most directly with today, and you'll hear from Jeff Smith later. And I'll just summarize. It seems to me that the broad policy decision would the legislature authorize unemployment insurance for locked-out workers was made years ago. And what this bill does is address a fairly narrow gap, that there's a certain set of circumstances that either consciously or unconsciously, maybe it fell through the cracks or maybe it was on purpose, but it's just one particular set of bargaining circumstances that's the exception to what or to a rule that was already figured out a long time ago. And to add to what Elizabeth mentioned in terms of the difference between authorizing a strike and actually walking out, this isn't a perfect example, but it kind of hit me when I was in the audience that I've seen legislators plenty of times take courtesy votes in a committee, but reserve the right to make a different choice on the floor. And you have workers who will make a courtesy vote, who will support their workers doing what they want to do, which is strike their employer. But when it comes time for them, they reserve the right to make a different decision in terms of walking off the job at a future time. Finally, I would say that the idea that unemployment insurance is going to be somehow be an inducement for labor strife, that it's some kind of subsidy or gold mine, there's not a worker who's going to say, sweet, we're locked out, I get UI. UI slows your descent to being broke. That's all. So this will restore some balance to an imbalanced situation in a narrow, and let me just emphasize, it is a narrow set of collective bargaining circumstances. I don't know anything about multi-employer bargaining, and I didn't know anything about it. I knew even less about it until the longshore workers got locked out years ago. And I was surprised that there's this gap in a law that's already been dealt with for other workers a long time ago. And with that, I'm happy to try to answer any questions.
So these are, Mr. Shepherd, the current laws that exist only applies to longshore workers and grocery workers, or are there others?
Arthur can speak to others. What I'm aware of is that these multi-employer bargaining circumstances in and of themselves are rare, and the industries in which they currently most often exist are in the longshore industry and the grocery industry. There are certainly others, but we have many, many unions in our federation, 100,000 workers. This only comes up with us, with the longshore workers.
Okay. And I will put a potential conflict of interest on the record, though I don't think I have one, but my stepfather is retired longshore.
Oh.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers, political director for SCIU Local 503, and I simply am here today to put our union on record in support of this legislation. It's a narrow piece of labor law, but it's a very important piece of labor law, and we simply wanted to add our voice to the testimony you've already heard. Thank you very much.
Mr. Towers, do any of your union members, are they subject to the multi-employer?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, at this point, I don't think so.
Okay.
We are expanding more into private sector organizing,
right.
And this situation may occur.
Okay, so that would be your interest, other than supporting your brethren and sister.
Okay. That's correct.
Madam Chair, Elizabeth Kushwa, if you'll allow me one more quick thing.
Sure.
Collective bargaining is really a good tool for everybody. it works well for everybody. It ensures that employers don't undercut each other in the marketplace. It ensures a fair living wage for the workers. This is also in response to a situation that's happened in California where workers were locked out, grocery workers were locked out for over 100 days. I don't know about any of you, but I'm a single supporter of three kids, and I don't want to go 100 days without a paycheck. But when I started learning about this bill, they were then in 21 separate union negotiations with 21 separate companies as a result of this lockout situation. I don't think that anybody would really want to preside over the death of collective bargaining, but that is, you know, in the laws of unintended consequence, this is one of them. This is where something like that could stop. And I think it would hurt everybody, the employers and the employees.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Melinda Merrill and Gary Oxley, please.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Melinda Merrill. I'm the Director of Public Affairs for Fred Meyer Stores. I'm here to testify today against HB 3339. I'm here on behalf of Carl Wojciechowski, who is our Group Vice President of Human Resources. He's currently in negotiations in Seattle, so he's unable to be here today. Fred Meyer Stores has an 85-year history in Oregon. We provide 13,000 Oregonians with living wage jobs with health and welfare and pension benefits. Currently, more than 70% of our employees are unionized. We have a 40-plus year relationship with the unions, with our employees' union representatives. Here in Oregon, it's with USCW Local 555. We have had labor disputes in that 40-year relationship, as any employer, I think, would, but our relationship with our employees' union is strong, and we certainly respect their rights to collective bargaining, and we respect the benefits that that brings. We're very concerned about 3339 because of a couple things that it will do to a system that has actually worked well for our employees and for us for many, many years. It will create a situation where the state is aiding the unions in a strike. The state will essentially be lending support to unions in a labor dispute, and it could result in an inequitable situation where some employees who are on strike will not have unemployment, while others at their competitors, who will be part of the same negotiations and the same strike, will have unemployment insurance. Currently, as you've heard, the grocery industry bargains in a multi-employer situation. We're currently in multi-employer bargaining negotiations with Local 555 in Eugene right now with Safeway and Albertsons, and the outcome will affect employees throughout Central and Southern Oregon. The main benefit of multi-employer bargaining is that it creates a level playing field. It creates a situation where employees across the industry are receiving the same wages and benefits for the same work, and ensures that the same conditions apply across the industry. When unions and employers agree to multi-employer bargaining, they sign an agreement prior to entering into negotiations. The agreement provides that a strike against one is a strike against all, as you've heard. So, if companies A, B, and C enter into a multi-employer bargaining agreement and the unions call a strike against employer A, B and C lock their employees out, and it's a defensive lockout. And it's termed a defensive lockout when the union and its members call a strike against one of the employers in the multi-employer bargaining unit. Employees and their unions agree to this up front. They know if they strike, it's considered a strike against all. And they have a second chance to consider this. They consider it first when they allow their union to enter into a multi-employer bargaining agreement. And then they have a second chance when they take a strike authorization vote and authorize their union to call a strike. Sorry, I just don't want to be redundant, obviously. Doing away with the unemployment exemption in a defensive lockout would, first of all, create an inequitable situation. The employees of the struck employer would not receive unemployment from the state, while the employees who are part of the defensive lockout would receive unemployment. So you'd have a group of employees who are on strike
do the same contract negotiations and same issues, and some of them would be getting unemployment and some of them would not. Doing away with it would also essentially do away with multi-employer bargaining. I don't know why we would enter into an agreement with the union when we know that if there's a strike, the state is going to help take away any incentive for the employees and their unions to go back to the bargaining table in a timely fashion. And doing away with the unemployment exemption could potentially prolong strikes because the employees would be receiving the unemployment benefits and not have quite the same incentive to go back. And I know that sounds a little harsh, but on the flip side, the employers are suffering as well, and we have the incentive of losing business. A strike is no good for anyone who's involved, and we don't want to prolong it either. And I think that's part of the reason why the situation exists today. So I ask you to please consider the effect this bill would have on a system that's been in place and worked well for more than 30 years. In the 30 years that we've been participating in multi-employer bargaining agreements with 555, there have been fewer than 6 strikes in Oregon and Southwest Washington. So the multi-employer bargaining situation works well and brings benefits to both sides. I can take questions.
Thank you, Ms. Merrill. Let's hear from Mr. Oxley first.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Gary Oxley, Oxley & Associates, appearing before you this morning on behalf of Fred Meyer and Safeway. I think Melinda has summarized the problematic concerns that both of my clients have with the bill. To not be redundant, I will cut my testimony off with saying that, other than adding that I would like to just restate for the record, one of the previous opponents of the bill said that perhaps you didn't understand the bill. We know that you thoroughly understand the bill and the mechanics of the bill. Our issues are that there are some problematic concerns we have with the nature of this proposed legislation.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Okay. Thanks very much for coming. We have Rick Ball and Jeff Smith, and that will tidy up this bill for now.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Rick Ball with UFCW, Local 555.
Okay. Would you like to go first?
Sure. My name is Rick. I'm a union representative. I'm sorry I have to read this. I don't have this all in my head, so I will read it.
Okay.
But I did get copies. I'm a union representative for United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 555. I'm here in support of House Bill 3339. I'm in the process of negotiating a labor contract with 1,200 grocery workers in the Eugene-Springfield area. The employers involved in these negotiations know that they can lock out these workers, thereby forcing them to accept lower wages and worse working conditions. Should the workers wish to fight the employers on these takeaways, the workers could be forced into an economic decline where they might lose their homes and be forced into leaving their communities to find work elsewhere. If House Bill 3339 were enacted, these lockout workers would have better chance at saving their homes, staying in their communities, and an ability to stay at the bargaining table to negotiate a fair settlement in their labor dispute. I urge you to support House Bill 3339. 3339 is a bill that, if passed, will set a wrong right in this state by allowing workers who have been forced out of work by their employers to have a minor but important safety net. We're not asking that the folks who actually are on strike receive unemployment. We're asking that the folks that are forced out of their employment by the employer to receive unemployment. The safety net will allow Oregon workers who have been forced into a lockout to keep their homes, feed their families, until the lockout is resolved. Employers have argued that if 3339 is passed, the state will be aiding workers in a strike. This argument by the employers could not be further off than the argument that the earth is flat. Workers have not told employers that they are going on a strike. They have only expressed their legal right to support other union brothers and sisters who happen to work for another company that they support their right to strike. It is the employers who decided to force these workers into a lockout. Workers, in fact, have told their employers they intend to stay on the job and they intend to work. I ask you if this kind of lockout is fair. Should Oregon laws allow employers to take away workers' livelihoods and to force workers into the possibility of bankruptcy just so that they can all aid each other in a little bit of market share? House Bill 3339 is not a bill, as employers would have you believe, that hurts them. No, it is, however, a bill that will help Oregon workers survive and remain in our communities during an economic attack by their employers until they are allowed to return to work. And I urge you all to support House Bill 3339. Thank you.
Mr. Ball, let me ask a question. When someone is unemployed, it's been, I'm self-employed, so I'm my own boss, but my husband works for someone, and he was unemployed back in 1983, big depression that we had in 83, and he was laid off by the city of Eugene, and I remember his unemployment benefits weren't all that good.
Well,
and we had to sign up for food stamps, and we were barely making ends meet. So someone doesn't want to be unemployed or go on strike and get unemployment benefits and just hang out because they're having a great time, because they don't get that much in benefits. Is that correct?
That's correct, if I can expand on that a little bit. A lot of our workers are 25 hours, 32 hours. They don't get 40 hours a week in this industry. Most people don't. They're struggling just to get hours and continue to work to pay their bills. If they're forced out and they do collect unemployment, most of our workers, because they're a little bit above part-time or some of them are below that, they're not going to get a lot of money. They're going to probably get, if they're at almost full-time, about $385 to maybe $450 a month. That doesn't even pay their house bills. That doesn't pay their mortgage bills. That doesn't feed their children. But it does help make ends meet. It does keep them alive for a little bit of time during the time that they go through the process of being locked out.
Okay. So I don't think anyone has an incentive to
hang out,
not on unemployment.
No, it's not being on the dole.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you, you must be Mr. Smith.
Greetings, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Jeff Smith. I reside in Portland, Oregon, in North Portland. I've been there all my life. I represent 600 members and affiliates of the ILWU in Portland. I'm also the president of the district council, the political arm of the ILWU. In that capacity, I represent an additional 1,000 members in Coos Bay, Astoria, Newport, and Portland. Hopefully, we'll make that number bigger in Coos Bay.
That's where my family, my mother and stepfather live.
I appreciate the opportunity to testify with respect to House Bill 3339. We support the bill as it serves to bring parity between the treatment of single-employer model workers and multi-employer model workers and the state of Oregon and its two neighboring states, California and Washington. In both neighboring states, where multi-employer groups lock out employees as a negotiating tactic, the locked out employees are eligible for unemployment benefits based on their past earnings. In Oregon, only where a single employer locks out its employees are those employees eligible for benefits. Employees of multi-employer groups are not eligible by law. The ILWU first learned of this discrepancy in treatment, not just between states, but in converge with the state of Oregon itself. When the multi-employer group Pacific Maritime Association, representing approximately 70 different companies, locked out 25,000 working longshoremen in the states of California, Oregon, and Washington in 2002. Bad memory. The lockout was short-lived after federal government intervention prohibited the tactic. Longshoremen in the states of Washington and California applied for and received employment benefits. Longshoremen in Oregon applied and were denied employment benefits. Had the Oregon longshoremen had not been employed by a multi-employer group, but in a more traditional single-employer model, they would have received employer benefits. This bill rectifies the discrepancy, and we urge its passage. And I just have a couple of comments, if I might make, and if that's okay, from some of the other speakers, and it's kind of good to be last here. Now, we can remember the governor's recent food stamp shopping sprees that he went on and how he lived on the $20 a week or whatever it was. you're not going to get rich off of being locked out and getting unemployment benefits. The big box stores, they're the people that we unload the containers for. They are the ones. The big box stores are representing in this 70 companies that I mentioned earlier. They're our employer groups. They locked us out. They couldn't get their goods to their stores. So I don't see any of those people here today to oppose this. I think they believe it's a good idea also. There's 30 other states within the United States that have this bill. There's a video coming out called Eye of the Storm, and I would like to make sure that, Madam Chair, you get a copy of that and review this video. It'll explain to you the negotiating tactics of how the lockout began in 2002.
Is this a news story?
It's going to, we're producing it right now, okay. And it's going to be distributed. We have somebody distributing it to like Discovery Channel and places like that. But we went to negotiate, and they didn't like what we liked. They just, we go to work one day, and the gates are locked. We didn't have anything to say about it, as was mentioned earlier. You know, it's. And aiding the state, I'm not sure where that came from, but I don't think the state is aiding anybody by doing that. So I'm done, and I'll take any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Any questions? Thank you, both. Great. I appreciate thank you. That you're here representing your members. Okay, we're going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3339. I'm going to hold that over till next week. So we can get back to the work session we have on our other bill today. So let me put my notes away. I will open a work session on House Bill 2140. Senator Cruz, do you have a motion?
I have several. Do you want one on this bill or just some random one?
Well, let's stick with this bill right now.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move the -A2 amendment to House Bill 2140.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves the -A2 amendment to House Bill 2140. Any discussion about that? Okay, so we're... And your next motion.
Okay, Madam Chair.
It's labor so hard.
This isn't easy. Okay. I know we're not doing that. And Madam Chair, I kind of wish at some point we had been able to also see the -19 to see what was so egregious about those to 2944. But, I mean, that was just a couple of days ago on another committee. But having said that...
Okay.
I will move House Bill 2140 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2140 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Do you want to speak to that motion?
Yeah. You know, I think there's good things, there's bad things. I suppose that's with a lot of what we do here. And I'm... as of today, and for Baker City, I absolutely support what you guys need in this. That's not my issue. But there may be some other issues in this. I'm going to support it today out of committee, but I'm going to do a lot more research into it before it actually hits the floor.
Okay. Senator Morse?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would be more comfortable holding this over and allowing a little more discussion to occur in terms of how we would approach resolutions of the issues that were raised this morning. If time does not permit that, then that's obviously a constraint. But I think there are some very serious issues raised. The intent I agree with, in the direction we need to go to find a bright line resolution. Certainly support the Baker City amendment, but There's some very, very significant issues raised this morning.
I think the very significant issue that you're speaking to, Senator, is the issue raised by the Treasurer's Office, mm-hmm. but I think that was answered pretty succinctly by Ms. Adamson and Mr. Shipwreck, that this came about because of rule and it can be changed by rule. I think they're quite comfortable with that, and they represent two very opposing views on the prevailing wage rate advisory committee.
The rule is not subject to our purview, is my concern.
Well, it never is. And so, I mean, it came about by rule, it can be fixed by rule, and yeah, we don't have anything to say about it, but the folks who serve on that advisory committee do, and you can bet they're looking out for the interests that you're concerned about. And it's a little bit like the MLAC committee. It's pretty balanced. Yes, Senator Metzger.
Well, I share Senator Morris's concerns, mm-hmm. but I feel we have the protective scenario of we're back in February, and if we feel the rules did not match the intent of the legislation and covered the areas, there will be plenty of opportunity 6 months after signing out to modify that if we're not satisfied.
Well, and I tend to forget about that because this is our first year of an experiment with coming back in an annual type session. And I agree, it was clear that we need this legislation on many levels. And I think that's just one small piece of it that raises concern, but I think it can be done in rule and we can come back in February and take care of it because those rules are going to have to be done pretty quickly. Does that make you feel more comfortable, Senator Morris?
I'll vote yes to move this along, okay. but it's with great concern that these issues be dealt with in a very judicial way mm-hmm. that doesn't just virtually gut out the longstanding financing mechanisms that we have in this state.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I understand that. Senator Wesley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's try to put this in context. I think we all sitting behind this dais, in fact, everyone in this audience knows that our prevailing wage laws are an issue and need clearer definition. I think this bill accomplishes that, maybe at a greater or lesser extent or, you know, in ways you don't agree with, but at least it adds some clarity. For that reason, I am going to be supporting this measure or this motion this morning. However, I think in the end of session rush, there are some issues, significant issues, that are left unaddressed, particularly as it relates to some longstanding public financing of private projects that need very clear definition. And I'm comfortable with the sincerity and the integrity of the individuals that testified before us this morning with regard to their intent to address that in rule. But I've got to tell you, I am concerned about not having that resolution further clarified in this legislation. And there is a February session, and I can assure everyone that I am going to be watching. This has grave potential for unintended consequences. So, having said that, Madam Chair, I will be a yes and support the motion.
Madam Chair, can I make just a couple more comments to what Senator Westland and Senator Metzger just said about the February session? I should have been keeping a running total on all the things that we have said we will deal with in February, because I'm not sure how we're going to do that all in a month. But which will be, it's going to be an interesting experiment. But we're assuming a lot of lookbacks in February, and it's a short month to start with. So,
I think we come in on Groundhog's Day.
Do we? Okay.
Well, that Valentine's
Day. That could go over and over. But
could over and over. Well, you know, some states stop the clock when they're under a timeline for the session. They just
stop the clock or roll it back. And yeah. But the other thing, Madam Chair, I'm going to do is have conversations with members of Senator Przanski's committee, who I think the majority of that committee would have moved this bill with Dash 19 amendments, which I have not seen, and find out why they had a greater comfort with that addition as well.
Okay. And Senator Marsh, you have a follow-up?
Just as a follow-up and elaborate my concern. Mr. Shiprack's comment was that the interpretation of that section that deals with the gross versus net with respect to financing.
Gross.
His interpretation was that it was gross.
Yeah.
Now we're going to pass this bill and send it back for rulemaking with an interpretation that already amplifies the problem. And so therein lies my concern, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Good point.
All right. I suspect, Senator Cruz, in response to your comment about all these things being thrown into the February session, my guess is that we're going to see more active interim committees than we've ever seen before, so that we can be prepared for a very short February session. So we are going to be working very hard in the interim, I think. So, okay, well, if there's no further discussion, Ms. Gravel, would you take the roll, please?
Senator Munster?
Aye.
Senator Morse?
Aye.
Senator Weston?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye. Your
size. It's a sigh.
House Bill 2140 is approved and it's headed to the Senate. I bet I have no volunteers for this.
Not me.
It's going to be me. Okay. All right. So, great job, committee. Next week is it for us. So we have moved over HGM 13 and HB 3339 will come up next week.
2021.
And House Bill 2021. Yeah, we've got a lot left on our plate. So thank you all for coming. We're adjourned.